We're here on Daf Yud Zayin Amud Beis, and we're going back to the Mishnah again to analyze the Mishnah. The Mishnah tells us that you'll see that on the top line, Im Yesh Edim Sheyatzas Binuma, that in order for her to prove at the time of the death of her husband or the divorce from her husband that she can collect a full ksuba of Masayim Zuz, that means she was married as a Basula, she has to bring proof. The burden of proof is on her to establish that that she was married as a Basula. So it seems that back in the day they had some sort of a ceremony at the chuppah, or maybe right after the chuppah, that indicated and demonstrated that she was a basula, and that's called yotzeis bihinuma. My hinuma, what is hinuma? Surcha bar papa, that's a name we only know from siyumim, mishmei de ziri omar, tanura da'asa. Usually the word tanura means an oven, but here it has a different meaning. The tanur here is an Aramaic word for a chuppah, and asa is, this we know from the third parak of Sukkah, is hadasim. And what they used to do is they made the chuppah out of hadasim, and that was an indication that it was a first marriage for her. Rabbi Yochanan Omar Karisa. You know, if you've ever seen at a badekin where they cover the face of the kala with a veil, so that's called karisa. And why is the word hinuma, which is the Aramaic form of the word tnuma in Hebrew? Hebrew tnuma means sleeping. Is dimenamnuma bakalsa, because since the face of the kala is covered by this krisa, this veil, therefore, even if she would take a little bit of a snooze, you know, she would doze off for a few minutes, nobody would know the difference. I just wanted to make one point before we go on, because this is not a Gemara that I want to spend too much time on. But it seems that there was a kind of a standardized minhag, we're not sure exactly what it was, that would demonstrate that she was a psula. Now, if you go back to the Mishnah, Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka offers another possible minhag that was a custom that was instituted for a first marriage for a young girl, and that is chiluk klayos. What they would do is they would divide, they would give out different kinds of nuts, and perhaps roasted kernels of wheat. Tana. So the Braisa says that Yehuda Raya, that all the minhagim, all the different customs that are listed here in the Mishnah that indicated that she was getting married for the first time, they apply in Yehuda. But Bibavel Mai. Apparently, they didn't have these traditions and these customs in Bavel. And therefore, the Braisa wants to know, in Bavel, was there some sort of a substitute for the above-mentioned traditions and customs in order to demonstrate that she was a Basula? In other words, the Gemara wants to know, in Bavel, how did you know, how would a woman prove that she was married as a basula? Amar Rav. Rav tells us that there was a minog in Bavel that indicated that she was a basula. And what's that called? That's called Dardoge de Mishcha. Apparently they used to wash their hair back in the day with a certain kind of an oil. It was like a shampoo, and they would be meshafshish, that means they would rigorously, you know, wash the hair with this the word mishcha means shemen, And dardoge is, I guess, a certain specific type of action that you do with the shemen to massage it into the hair. And what did they do with this shemen? They poured it areisha derabanan. It's very strange, but they poured it over the heads of the chachamim, of the talmidei chachamim. And that was a kind of a strange thing that would have such a powerful impact on the audience. Nobody could forget it when they saw it, that they would know that this was a sign that it was a first marriage. The Chasam Sofer wants to understand why, of all crazy things in the world, did they choose to do this as a siman? And there are two things about this that are really unusual, that are really crazy. Number one, usually this shemen was used by the amcha, you know, by the rank and file citizen. It wasn't something that was specific for talmidei chachamim. And secondly, if you were to pour this over the head of a talmid chacham, you certainly wouldn't want to do it with women. You know, that's not so tsanua. So here there were two changes. Number one, the women would pour shemen over the heads of men. And number two, who are these men? These men were the talmidei chachamim. So the Chasam Sofer says that this was a very unusual kind of a sight, you know, to see, and it would certainly be engraved in the memory of the participants in the wedding. Oh yeah, I remember at that wedding, that's what they did, and that they did it in order to demonstrate that she was a basula. But the Mefarshim won't understand, it seems like such a strange, you know, they could have done anything in the world that would be strange. Why did they choose this? So apparently, this goes back to a pasuk in Tanakh. The pasuk says, "Hine matov u'manoim sheves achim gam yachad kishemen hatov yored al hazakon," like the good oil that rolls down to the beard. And since the word shemen is in the pasuk, number two, the word zaken is in the pasuk, or zakon, meaning a zaken, they took the word zaken as a symbol for talmidei chachamim, and shemen, which is always used as a symbol of wisdom and of spirituality, of light, is also mentioned in this pasuk, kishemen atov yored al hazakon, and they put that together, and they did a meshicha on to the talmidei chachamim, and this was somehow related to the marriage. Why is it related to the marriage? Because the first part of the pasuk says, "Hinei matov manam kishevas achim gam yachad," and somehow, you know, talmidei chachamim marvim shalom la'olam, and therefore, if we want to indicate the peace and the harmony, or at least the prayer to Hashem that there should be peace and harmony in this marriage, they wanted to get the talmidei chachamim involved. And he quotes here Achina v'Chizda, which I think, if I'm not mistaken, is Rav Azulai. And he says that the remez here was that the zchus of Torah yogen aleihem. That Torah is always compared to shemen, and the merit of Torah study should protect them and grant them peace. Now, what about the case of an almana? At the wedding of an almana, they did not do this kind of ceremony of pouring shemen onto the head of on the heads of talmidei chachamim. But not only that, the Chasam Sofer wants to go a step further, and this I've never seen before. Maybe somebody could tell me they saw it. He says that at a wedding of a kala who's getting married for the first time, the chasan and the kala both wear white. Okay, that I've seen. But in the case of a second marriage, they do not wear white. And why is that? Because he says, with regard to a first marriage, it's pure simcha. 100%. You know, it's a first marriage, it's a wedding, everything is besimcha. But he says that if for her it's a second marriage, she lost her first husband, she's an almana, then even though there's the simcha, the happiness of a marriage, nevertheless, the marriage and the simcha is the simcha of this marriage is a little bit incomplete. There's a certain element of avelus that mars the simcha, that limits the simcha, because she was married to a man in her youth, and he's no longer, and now she's getting remarried. So there still is a little bit of a memory of the deceased, of the person who is no longer. And therefore, the Chasam Sofer says, in such a case, when Almani gets married, they tone down the simcha. He says that she doesn't wear the special tachshitim that she would wear in the first marriage. She doesn't wear white clothes as she would on the first marriage. And all this is because it's a little bit of drop of avelus. Now, when I read this Chasam Sofer, I was a little jarred by it. Like, why do we want to have any vestige of sadness and mourning at a wedding? I mean, that seems so antithetical. But then I thought to myself, you know what? There are so many minhagim about marriage that remind, so many dinim that remind us of avelus. Mm-hmm. The whole offer. Structure, what?
The offer, the...
Yeah, you put afer on the head, and I don't know if you've seen the minhag that they walk the chasen down with, you know, and the kallel down with candles, mm-hmm. the kittel, and there's so many things. In fact, the whole structure of simcha starts with the following. There's the first day of the Shiva Siman Mishnah, that has special status. Then we go to the 7 days. Then we have 30 days of Akala. And then we have Shana Rishona, which is a full year. Those numbers exactly parallel Avelus. Because the first day of Avelus, according to many Rishonim, is Doraisa. The balance of the Avelus, very intense, is the Shiva. And then we go to a lower level of Shloshim until finally, for a parent, it's Yudeis Chodesh. Mm-hmm. It's like mind-boggling. It's almost like the halacha in a kind of a play, of, you know, almost plays with us here. What word am I looking for? It's ironic. Yeah, that was the word. It's a kind of ironical parallel between Avelus and Simcha. And maybe in a certain sense, again, I don't want to get morbid here, but every simcha really has, in a sense, a potential for avelus in it, because, you know, man's situation is very tragic. You know, on the one hand, it's great, you know, he's a young person getting married, he's got, you know, he's got love in his eyes, and he's got dreams, and I, you know, ideas about how everything is going to work out. But on the other hand, man is vulnerable. He's a human being. You know, he's mortal. He's flesh and blood. In any event,
I was going to say, the Gemara in Sotah says, and this, and this week's parsha Vayikach, that bas the marriage of the parents of Moshe. So the Gemara asks, why does it say Vayikach? If it was a second marriage. Because we assume that's a...
That low level of simcha, you mean?
Right.
Because the second marriage?
So Gemara answers that they celebrated it as if it was the first marriage.
Ah, I see. Okay. In certain cases, I guess you could elevate the simcha to that of a first marriage. Fine. Let's go on. The Gemara says that Rav Papa was very surprised. He had never heard of this custom of pouring oil onto the heads of the Talmidei Chachamim. Amalei Rav Papa Abaye, Mishcha Dechafifusa Ka'omar Mar. So first he asked him, was this oil, the oil that was used to wash one's hair as a kind of shampoo? And he was surprised, because if that be the case, then, you know, what happens if a person comes, you know, comes to a wedding and he's got the shemen on his hair because he's, you know, I don't know exactly how many hours they wore the shemen on the hair until they actually showered or whatever. What did he say? And it might not be indicative of the fact that it's the first marriage. You know, it doesn't seem to be a simon, because maybe the reason why there was shemen on his hair is because they used it as a shampoo. Amalei. So Abaye turns back to Rav Puff and he says, Yasma, which literally means Yatom. You know, you're an orphan, meaning you've been orphaned from this minhag. Orphan is now, the word orphan or Yatom is used as a symbolic meaning of alienation. You know, you're alienated from this minhag. It's totally
disconnected.
Unfamiliar. You're disconnected. Lo avdalach imach, did your mother not implement this custom at your wedding? Dardoge mishcha areisha derabbanan? Like, why is this so surprising to you? You know, why is this catch you off guard? Didn't your mother do this at your wedding? Pishas maisa, at the time of your wedding. Kiha, and Abai goes on and tells a story about a certain wedding. Hahubi Rabbanan, you know, one of the rabbis, the Yasek Le Libre, he set up a wedding for his son, Be Rabba Bar Ula, with the daughter of Rabba Bar Ula. Amri Le Yod to say it was a different wedding, it was Rabba Bar Ula, Yasek Le Libre, Be Ahubi Rabbanan, maybe it was Rabba who was marrying off his son to one of the rabbis, but in any event, at the wedding, Dardeg Mishcha Areisha Derabbana B'Shas Maisa. They actually implemented this very minhag, and they poured the oil on the heads of the Talmidei Chacham. So Abai wants to tell Rav Papa that I'm very surprised that you're surprised. Yeah, I'm very surprised that you don't recognize this custom. Fine, Armalasa Mai. Okay, all this is at a first marriage. What about a second marriage? In other words, there should be some sort of a sign indicating, demonstrating that this is a second marriage, so that if she comes to claim a ksuba of Masayim, then they'll reject her claim because we have testimony that this was a second marriage. Tani Rav Yosef, Armalasa Lesla Kisne Kisane. In other words, there was no need to actually institute a special custom and wave a flag to demonstrate that this was the marriage of an almana. All they had to do was omit those customs that were unique for the marriage of a basula for first marriage. So kisne was that custom that we spoke about before, where they give out kloyos and agozim, you know, they divvy it up to the children. And that was deliberately omitted at the marriage of an almana. So I just want to read to you, he has a summary of the language of the Shita Mekubetzes here. He says the following. Kushas HaGemara, what was bothering the Gemara? Came unto Bavel, since in Bavel the simon was Dirduge Mishcha, that was the only simon they had, in Kemawa simon Balmana, what would indicate that it was a second marriage? Yitachen, he says, Shema shelo asu Dirduge Mishcha, mishum shelo hayisham rabbanan b'chupa. Maybe there were no great scholars at the chupa, so that's why they didn't implement this minhag. And therefore, ein raya mikach, there's no proof from the omission of this custom. Shall also tasimon l'almana. Shalmani, it doesn't prove that she's an almana. Maybe there just were no chachamim invited to the wedding. Of course, you and I can't imagine such a situation where it would be a wedding without talmidei chachamim. He says, al karchok, therefore, tzorech simon shalmana hi. We have to do something that would indicate that she's an almana, because otherwise, just the absence of Dirduge the Mishcha might just be attributed to the fact that there were no Chachomim at the wedding.
But in a lot of cases, second marriage is a small wedding.
Right, it's a small wedding. So how are you going to prove that she was married for the second time? You're going to say, well, they didn't do this thing with the Shevin. That doesn't prove a thing. Maybe there were just no Talmidei Chachom available at that small wedding. Al Zeh Tirta Gemara, Shemisha Ein Lo Klayos Vadei Almonahu. In other words, as opposed to the Duge Mishcha, which requires the presence of Talmidei Chachamim, Chiluk Klayos was done at every single wedding, and if it was omitted at a wedding, that was a sure proof that she was an almana. Why didn't they do the Chiluk of Klayos? Okay, fine.
Don't we pass in, I think today the minhag is, and the other minhagim we don't have, but the Deccan isn't done at a second wedding.
Uh-huh. So maybe the absence of a Deccan would prove that she's an almana.
One of the examples that's brought, I was at a second wedding recently, and the Deccan is not done is that correct?
So that would indicate what we said before.
Right, in other words, that's another example. If that's not done there, then you know
that the Hinua, which is the veil, according to Rabbi Yochanan,
right,
was a simon that she was being married for the first time. That's the Badekin.
Mm-hmm. I'm saying we pass, that's the minhag today. Is that correct? Or?
I don't know. I honestly don't. I never saw a Badekin at a second marriage. Second marriages usually go really chicha. You know, sometimes they do it in someone's living room.
I remember I asked the rabbi about it and said that's not the
living room.
It's not
the living room or in the Yeltsin.
You don't do a Badekin.
Yeah. Okay, Rabosai. So all that, I'm just, you know, what we've done until now is just to pay you for what we don't want to skip, even though I would have skipped this Gemara. But now we get to the sugya that we want to study tonight. Okay. What are we dealing with? Let's just review and introduce the next Gemara. Rabbi Yeshua, in the first parak of Ksubis, rejects the concept of migu. And for example, if we find a woman and Aiden testify about this married woman that she was alone with another man, forget about a married woman. Let's say she's a pnuya, right? She's never been married. And she was alone with a man. And we ask her, who was this man? You remember this? And the question is whether he was a Kohen, a Kosher, or he's an apostle, maybe he's a Mamzer, maybe he's a Nosin, maybe he was a Goy. And she says, Kohen v'Kosher havi. Although Rabbi Lazar and Rabbi Gamliel believe her, because she has a migu, she couldn't deny that there was ever a relationship, because all the Edom saw was Yehud. Rabbi Yeshua says, we don't believe her. She doesn't have the credibility of believing her, and the Kohanim are not allowed to marry her, and so forth and so on, because we don't rely on Miku. That's Perek Aleph. Now we're in Perek Beis. So we've really made some progress. And here, Rabbi Yeshua says the following, that there is one kind of Amigu that I rely upon, and I validate. That's called a Pesha Asar. In the language of the Gemara, that's called Ein Shar Shachet Lefanech, which means that a person in the present state, there's no claim against him whatsoever. No one thinks that he owes them money. No one thinks that he owes them money. He himself offers the information that might lead to the conclusion that he owes them money. And then he says, but I don't owe you money. What's the case? He's living on a field, right? And he says to so-and-so, this field belonged to your father, but I purchased it from him. That so-and-so, the Ben, has no idea, no clue that this piece of land, this karka, ever belonged to his father. And therefore it's Ein Shar Shachet Lefanecha. He doesn't have any claim against the machzik, against the one who's having a chazokah now. The machzik himself, by his own admission, testifies that it did belong to your father. So where's your shtar? You know, if you purchased it from my father, you should have a document testifying to that effect. And lo and behold, the machzik has no shtar. We believe, and even Rabbi Yeshua believes. Why? Because he didn't have to say anything. That's called Ein Shar Shach Lefanecha. If not, you have a woman, for example, we have no clue that she was ever married. She comes forward and says, I was married, but I was divorced. Okay, she can't marry Cohen, by her own admission, but she can marry Yisra. That's called a Pesha Asar Peshi. We had no reason up front to suspect that she was a married woman. She had a Cheskas Pnuya. She herself tells us a story which we weren't at all aware about. We had no claim or suffix about her. And that's called a Pesha Asar Peshi. Our sugya is now going to focus on the following question. Why did the Mishnah, in illustrating Rabbi Yeshua, give us a very complicated case? Ma'aseh misurba'al. Why not give me a simple case? Lama sabechotan. Why did he make it confusing to us? Instead of saying, well, this karka belonged to your father and I bought it from you, he could have said, this karka belonged to you and I bought it from you. Okay, let's just see. I hope your mind's already working on a shlug up, but let's see the Gemara. Umod Rav Yeshua, I'm going to read the whole Mishnah. Be Omer lechaveru sod zushal avicha haisa ulekachtiyah mimenu shu neman shapesah shu peshehite. So the Gemara wants to know if the purpose of the Mishnah is to teach us that according to Rav Yeshua, a person is believed with a peshas a peshehita when there's no claim against him at all. Listen, why not give us the case of Moder Rav Yeshua? Be Omer lechavero sada zu shalcha haisa, this sada once belonged to you, ulekachtiyah mimenu mimcha, I bought it from you. Wouldn't that have been a simpler case? Why do you have to introduce the father into the picture? Oh, this sada once belonged to your father, and I bought it from him. Why not just simply, this sada belonged to you, and I bought it from you? So what would you say, Brian? Why is that case a little bit odd?
Because if you don't say to that the thing belonged to you, you'll remember if you...
Sure, you should know whether it belonged to you or not. Again, the whole premise of Rabbi Yeshua's Peshas Peshahitir is that the other fellow doesn't know anything about this sada. He doesn't think he has any claim whatsoever. He didn't know that it once belonged to his father. He had no way of... He wasn't privy to that information. His father never told him.
As if it was his, he
would know. But if it was his, he would know. So the Sam Sofer says, and this is a very complicated case where a person owns something and he doesn't even know he owns it. What's the case? So this is very interesting. A ger who dies, nechasav hefker. What does it mean? If he has no children that were born to him after the gerus, and he died tragically, it's a shame that he died without children. Again, he may have biological children, but he doesn't have any Jewish children. And Gersh and his guy could cut and shenola tummy, so he's not related to any of his biological relatives. Then there's no Yorish. So what happens to his possessions? He owns fields and fields and fields, and he dies. So the answer is, those fields are Hefker. What does Hefker mean? First come, first serve. Whoever grabs it first, snatch the bag. He made the kolakot of Zoch, he made the kinyan, and it's his. This fellow, in the Gemara's, you know, question, in the case that the Gemara is imagining, this fellow made a kinyan on Nichse Hager. But he doesn't know how far the field extends. In other words, when you make a kinyan on a karka, that kinyan could be made... You don't have to run around the entire karka and, you know, circulate it, or whatever the word is, you know, like kivut kol karka. That he doesn't have to do. If he makes a kinyan on the karka, which is called nal gadar aparatz, let's say he, you know, he puts up a lock on the door, then he's kona the entire field. In this particular case, says the Ksav Sofer, the person who made the kinyan on Nitzah Ger was unaware of how far and how extensive that sada goes. So in his mind, the sada only went to, you know, what do they call it? The surveyors will tell you up to what, you know, longitude and latitude until what point. But he didn't know that his field went even further than that. So let's imagine a funny kind of case that you make a kinyan on Hefker and you're not even aware of the extent of that kinyan. So comes along so-and-so, and he says, you know what? You had a kinyan on this field. You're not aware of it, but I know it, but I bought it from you. Again, once again, the Ksav Sofer is going to ask the same question. How does he know, how does he not know that he bought it from him? You know, how did that happen? And then he says, well, maybe he gave the money over to a shliach, or he put it into his bank account, whatever happened, and he wasn't aware of it. So Bekitzer, to make a long story short, the Gemara thinks that you can imagine a scenario of Peshas and Peshahit there without introducing the father into the picture. There must be, that's the underlying premise of this Gemara, some sort of special chidush that the Mishnah wants to tell me about the father. About the fact that the karka once belonged to this guy's father, and a machzik who's now sitting on the land claims that he bought it from the karka. The listening moder of Yeshua ba'omer l'chaver sada zu shalcha haisa ulekachtiyah heimeno. This sada once belonged to you, and I bought it from you. Okay. So the Gemara answers, Mishum de Kavoy le Misnei Sefer. The Mishnah has two parts to it. The Reisha is Sada Zushal of Vichahai Savalakhti Amir. And the Sefer says, but if Yesh Edim Shehishalo, if there are two witnesses on the face of the globe that testify that this character once belonged to the father, it's no longer Shar Shachet Lefanecha, because now we have independent evidence to establish that the character belonged to his father. And the Machzik is claiming that he purchased the field from the father. Eino Neman. In this case, he doesn't have a Peshas or a Peshahitim. What's the case? Eichidami. Idi Achla Shnei Chazaka. If he ate the Karka for 3 years, what does it mean to eat the Karka? I don't mean, you know, like the serpent does. If he produces the fruits of the Karka and he markets them and he enjoys the financial benefits, the profits of the karka, that's called a cheskas gimel shanim, is a milo mehemen. Why shouldn't he believe to say that he purchased the karka? V'idolo achlo shnei chazok, if he did not live on the karka and work the land, exploit the land to its maximum for 3 consecutive years, is pshita delo mehemen. That's a mishnah at the beginning of the third paragraph of Basra, that a person cannot claim he bought karka and he doesn't have a shtar to prove it, unless he has cheskas gimel shanim. So the only substitute for a shtar in a case of a purchase of karka is cheskas gimel shanim. So what is the Mishnah telling me that if there are eidim that this karka belonged to the father, then he's not believed? Well, if he has cheskas gimel shanim, then he certainly should be believed to say he bought it from the father. If he doesn't have cheskas gimel shanim, then pshita, the Mishnah didn't have to tell me this. It would just be reiterating what we know already from the Mishnah in Baba Basra, that if you don't have cheskas gimel shanim, where's your shtar? Good. So the Gemara says, okay, so now you've asked the question, and we'll see how to resolve that question, but that question is valid even if I go back to the Mishnah itself. Meaning, the Gemara wanted to object and say, forget about the father. Let's leave him, cut him out of the picture. Let's just say, Sadezu Shalcha Haisalakhti Avimen. So you have a problem. If that be the case, why would the Mishnah add Yesh Edim? But, Ihachi, if that's your question, is Gabi Aviv Nami? You haven't solved that problem in the case of Aviv. By introducing the father into the picture, you've not resolved your issue. Because, again, I can ask the same Mimon of Shach, no matter how you slice it. E the Achle Shnei Chazaka. If the Machzik ate 3 years of Chazaka, Milo Mehemen. Why shouldn't he be believed to say that it's his field? V the Lo Achle Shnei Chazaka. Pshita the Lo Mehemen. For sure he's not believed. So the Gemara now is going to claim that the reason why Rebbe, when he authored the Mishnah, he formulated it in the case, the scenario of Aviv, is because now there's a great chiddush in the Sefer, in the case of Eden. Why? Bishlei Magabi Aviv, in the case where the Machzik is claiming that this field belonged to your father, I can explain very well why I need the Reisha of the Mishnah and the Sefer of the Mishnah. They're both necessary. Mishkachas Lei, I need a Chiddush in the following scenario. Kigon, She'ochla, Shtayim, B'chaye Ha'ov. He ate 2 years worth of Chazaka during the father's lifetime. And again, this is all evidenced by two Edim. You know, it's not just that he's claiming that we have to believe him, but there are Edim to testify to that effect. The achas in the third year of Chazaka, b'chaye bno. Now this son, we have to understand, is a katan. If he's a gadol, then we can assume that he's aware of all of the financial situations that are relevant to his yerusha. Let's assume again, Martin. But work with me on this. If on the other hand he's a katan, he doesn't know anything. He doesn't know beans about his father's possessions and so forth and so on. What did he inherit and what did he not inherit? And therefore, he's completely out of the picture as far as this field is concerned. The Tana, therefore, wants to tell me a chiddush here. That the machzik could not claim chazaka based on the 3 years consecutively that he's been eating the field. Why? Because although the first 2 years can count as shnei chazaka, because the father was alive, but with regard to the third year, that cannot be included in the minyan, in the counting of 3 years, because the chazaka has to be against the original owner. The owner here in this case is a katan who inherited this field from his father. And you can't make a chazaka against the katan because your chazaka is predicated on the fact that the katan, who really and truly owns the field, should have made a machai, should have made a protest. Why are you living off my field? Get out of here. But in the case of a katan, we can't expect the katan to be mature enough and to be aware of the fact that this is his field and someone is exploiting his field and setting up a chazaka on his field. So that third year of chazaka is absolutely meaningless. And therefore the machzik only has 2 years of chazaka, not 3 years of chazaka. So what's the chiddush of our Mishnah? The Gemara says that our Mishnah is coming to tell you what Rav Huna told us. Kid Rav Huna, what did Rav Huna say? The Omer Rav Huna, Ein machzikin benichsei katan. You cannot establish a chazok against a katan. Vafilu higdil. In other words, when the machzik went down into the karka, the owner of the karka was a katan. Now the katan became a gadol. He had a big bar mitzvah celebration. And the machzik continued his chazaka for another 3 years until this child was 15 years old. Was 16 years old, right?
No, 15.
15 or 16? 13?
14,
15. Okay, so again, 13 plus 3. I would say that that's 16, but you could say it's 15. Whichever way you can debate this. This is Zeno's paradox. This is a great paradox back in the time of the Greek philosophers. Okay, I'm just joking, but anyway. Yeah. The point is that what's critical to establish a chazaka is that the first moment of chazaka was valid. It was against the gadol. If the first moment, the initial chazak was established against a katan, then in such a case, that chazak could never become a chazak. If not for Rav Huna, I would have thought, okay, we can't calculate that period of time of chazak when the Marakam, the original owner, was a katan, but later on, when he becomes a gadol, now we can start, the ticker tape starts moving, and we calculate three years of chazaka. The answer is no. Says Rav Huna, what's engraved in stone, what determines what's koveh the chazaka, is the initial moment of chazaka. If at that initial moment of chazaka, the machzik established his domicile in this karka, the marakam was a katan, then that's it. That chazaka is completely invalid. It has no recognition in halacha. Can never become a chazaka, even if the katan became a gadol.
So could he move out when he turns bar mitzvah and then come back like a day later and then it starts again? Or it's
he doesn't want to do that because. One second, who are we talking about? We're talking about the original owner.
No, the
machzik.
The machzik.
Can he leave and
restart the chazaka, or because it happened once, it's there forever?
I don't know. That's an excellent question. What's the logic of Rav Huna? And then maybe we can answer your question. The logic of Rav Huna is that if the beginning of the chazaka, when the son saw, he saw so and so living in the field, right? The child, the minor in this case, thought that the field belongs to him.
To the machzik.
In other words, the child had no clue, because of his immaturity and in terms of that, this is a person who's not legally, rightfully in the karka, that he's illegitimately usurping karka. The katan had no way of knowing that. Okay. So now the katan becomes a gadol. Why didn't he make a macha? Why didn't he complain about it? The answer is, he was already under the impression from the get-go that this person, this machzik, is the rightful owner of the karka. He had no reason to suspect otherwise. He wasn't aware of the fact that this karka was his father's and he inherited it. So when he looks at the reality of so-and-so, the machzik, living in the karka, he thinks, you know what, the machzik is the legitimate owner of the karka. Even later, when he gets to the age of godless, he still is under the same impression. Nobody wakes him up and tells him, hey, you better make a macha against this person. So I think, therefore, the answer to Aaron's question might be that even if the machzik would check out and then go back in, it wouldn't make any difference, because in the mind of the former katan, who's now a gadol, this is his karka. He's the legitimate owner of the karka. That's what I would suggest. So the Gemara says, what are you telling me? That the chiddush of the Mishnah is that since the initial chazaka took place during the lifetime of the father, and that's why the Mishnah introduced the father, therefore that chazaka will never get off the ground, it will never materialize and realize itself as a chazaka, even after the father dies, and even after his son, the katan, becomes a gadol. If that be the case, then Rav Huna masnisen asa lashminon, is Rav Huna just telling me what we know from the Mishnah? If that's what the Mishnah is saying. So where it says, Ibai Seimer Rav Huna diyuka de masnisen kamar, the Mishnah doesn't say it explicitly. So we need Rav Huna to come along and interpret the Mishnah in that light. Ibai Seimer second answer, afilu higdil kamashpulan. If we only had this Mishnah, we would say that this halach of the Mishnah that invalidates the chazak is because the original owner, the rightful owner of this karka, is still a katan, but when he becomes a gadol and he starts investigating his father's possessions and properties and the Yerusha that he inherited, at that point maybe we should say he becomes aware of the fact that somebody is squatting on his land and he should make a macha. Kamash Malah, the Mishnah wants to teach us, I'm sorry, not the Mishnah, Rav Huna wants to teach us, no, that since the initial chazaka took place when the Marakama was a katan, therefore it never ever can mature and become a valid chazaka. So the Gemara says, wait a second, this whole spiel about 2 years of chazaka during the father's lifetime, and then the third year, which would have been the clincher of the chazaka, took place when the father died and the child was a katan. I could imagine that same chiddush even without the father. How so? Listnei b'didei. Let's go back to our original question, our objection against the Mishnah. The machzik is saying to the marakama, sadezu shalcha haisa, vilakachtia heimena. And we could still construct this kind of chazaka that's not a chazaka. How so? Look me kagon sha'ochla shtayim b'fanav. 2 years of chazaka, the machzik ate in the presence of the marakam. Again, when we say the presence, we don't mean literally in front of his eyes, but it means in a place where it's accessible for him to find out. The achas shelo b'fanav. But the third year took place when the original owner, the Marakama, was out. He was far away. Why was he far away? Kigon Shebarach. He had to run away from the law. He was a fugitive. And if he was a fugitive, he can't show up and make a macha. In other words, the whole idea of 3 years of chazaka is that the Marakama can't tolerate this. He's got at one point to get, you know, run into Beis Din, or at least get two Eidim and make a macha and yell and scream, this guy's squatting on my land, get rid of him, he's illegitimate.
He was a fugitive.
But the third year he became a fugitive. He got in trouble with the law. And again, we allow him to up to 3 years to make the macha. When it got to the third year, he had to run away. And therefore he doesn't want to raise his head from the clandestine secret place that he's hiding. Because if he does so, the law is going to catch up with him. So he's living underground. And therefore, he doesn't make a macha, because a macha has to be public in nature. He has to make sure that that the machzik is aware of his macha. And therefore, the machzik has to watch his shtar, according to his claim that he bought the land and he purchased it with a shtar.
It sounds like a Murphy movie.
So the Gemara says, why couldn't he make a mecha? You say he's a fugitive. The Gemara says, Barach machmas mai. You know, you can get in trouble with the law because you're suspect of a capital crime. And if the law gets a hold of you, you're in trouble. You're going to get hung, right? So, e de barach machmas nefashos, which means, excuse me, that the police are after him to put him to death. You know, the government wants to try him and put him to death. Pshita de lo mehemin. Certainly, there's no chazaka here. De lo matzi mache, because, you know, the original owner cannot come and surface himself, appear in public to make him a mecha, because the malchus will get a hold of him and they'll behead him. V'i debarach machmas mamon. If, on the other hand, he's running away because there are creditors that are after him, you know, to try to squeeze him and force him to pay whatever he has to pay, and therefore he's now running, he ran away, you know, to a far-off country, is he boy leilu mechuye? He still has a requirement to make a mecha wherever he is. Now, wait a second. The whole purpose of the mecha of the protest is to send a message to the machzik that you better hold on to your shtar because I made a mecha. Now that means that the mecha has to reach the ears of the machzik. Now if the machzik, I'm sorry, if the marakama ran all the way to China and he's going to make a mecha in China when the karka is here in Yerushalayim, then how is the machzik going to hear about the mecha?
Internet.
So Gemara says, what do you say?
People travel. People talk.
Okay, good. That's going to be the call, the idea of a call. Iboy leilu mechuye. Let him make a mecha wherever he is. Why? The kaimalon, the Gemara says the following, we paskin, that mecha shelo befanov, hav ye mecha. Okay, this is a major controversy in Masechta Bava Basra Perek Gimel. Is it valid to make a mecha in a far-flung place? That's called a mecha shelo b'fanav. Again, keep in mind, shelo b'fanav doesn't mean literally that it's not in his presence, but it means it's far away. And we're going to have to analyze the sugya and the mishnah in Cheskes Habatim in order to come to some definite conclusion as to whether or not you can make a mecha in one country and it's a valid mecha because the premise is it'll reach him in another country. Today we have Facebook and we have WhatsApp and whatever you have, so there are many ways of establishing that the machzik would hear about the mecha, but in those days it was all a question of travels back and forth. It's called shayaros.
How do we know?
So let's say, for example, Eretz Yisrael is divided up into three districts. There's Yehuda, there's Goliel, there's Evrei Yarden. So let's say, for example, the machzik is here in Yehuda, and the marakama had to flee to Goliel, because here in Yehuda they're after him. You know, they're pressing him to pay up his debts. So he's up in the Galil, and he's going to make a mecha. And the question is, are the shayaros mitzuyos, you know, are the travelers going back from Goliel to Yehuda and back and forth so that we can validate the meaningfulness of the mecha?
How do we know that the machzik has to hear the mecha?
That's an interesting question.
Why doesn't it work like if you find a lost object and you just magically, the other person, you assume him to be, you know, what's it called? Where he loses.
Who are we talking about? We're talking about the finder?
Yeah.
The finder has to make achrozo. Is that what you're talking about?
No. The finder can rely on the fact that the person who lost it doesn't believe he'll find it again, and therefore, because he believes he won't find it again, automatically it's his.
Yeah.
That doesn't require communication. Why does it require communication? Why can't it just...
Well, again, yeish only operates in very, very specific cases where we have reason to believe that the loser knows that he lost the object. Is that what you're talking about? How does the loser know that he lost the object? So Gemara says, for example, let's say he always checks his pocket so he knows they dropped his money or something like that. But if he the halacha really is that if you find something, you have to assume the worst scenario, that the loser is unaware of the fact that he lost it. That's called yeush shelo midas, and therefore the yeush is totally inoperative. But there's another halacha that I think is more relevant to us, and that's called hachraza. The finder has to make a public announcement
every
regular or whatever it is, that I found something. Now, how does that operate? The answer is that the one who dropped it, who's the rightful owner, is going to hear about the achrozah. How do you know he's going to hear about the achrozah?
Yeah.
So the Gemara works with a premise, but again, I don't know how that applies in our time, but back in the day, that there was a mitzvah of aliyah leregel, and the loser knew that outside the Beis HaMikdash, there was a place that was designated where anyone who found something would make an announcement to that effect, and if he knew that he was, you know, he lost something, he would show up at the regel and go to that specific place. You know, it's like, what's that place called in London where you get up and you just harangue? What's it called?
Hyde Park.
Yeah, there's a Hyde Park outside the Beis HaMikdash. So the person who lost something would show up in the Hyde Park and he would wait to hear if somebody found it. Or the Gemara offers other possibilities, that in every city there was a place designated for these announcements. You know, it's like a lost and found kind of board. But getting back to the case of Machzik, there's going to be an entire battle here about whether or not the Machzik, the Marakama, could assume that his Macha will be heard, will be registered in the ears of the Machzik, if they're in two different countries, if they're far away from each other. Mm-hmm. Now, I think, Aaron, what bothers you, and it certainly bothers me, is that who cares whether the machzik hears about the mecha? Mm-hmm. And the answer is that the whole institution of hazakah is to avoid the following scenario. When you buy a field, what does that mean? That in order to prove your title over the field, you have to hold on to the shtar for the rest of your life?
The title office,
maybe? Yeah, okay, but back in the day it wasn't as sophisticated as it is today, where you registered in the...
Rabbi, it's not so sophisticated.
No?
I'm dealing with a case now where they can't find the target or property.
It got lost somewhere.
Got lost.
Maybe it was never registered or something.
I'm asking to prove that it's his.
That's it.
So it's a Yerusha Bidyuk, this
right. Story. So the answer is, you know how you prove a purchase? You have a shtar. But the Gemara assumes that it's impossible, it's almost humanly impossible, to ask a person to hold on to a shtar. Again, this may sound a little bit humorous to you, but the Gemara assumes that the mice love to eat up shtars. And wherever you... You know, again, we don't hopefully have so many mice, we also have mice, but they eat up shtars. You know, maybe the cloth is something that has a good smell for the mice and so forth and so on. So the Gemara says, how are we going to defend or protect the position of a buyer who purchased a piece of land for who knows how much, home to our phone, and we can't expect him to endlessly hold on to his shtar? At one point or another, he misplaces the shtar. I mean, I always say that my vision of Olam Haba is that I'm going to find all the things that I can't find. You know? And it could probably fill up a whole room, because every 5 minutes I'm looking for something. My wife is, by the way, just as bad as I am. You know, we're tied for last. You know, and the older you get, it just gets worse.
Your glasses are on your head.
Right, the glasses are on your head, right, that kind of thing. So what do you do to protect the interests of a buyer? And again, the whole economic system that Chazal envisioned was that we want buying and selling. Who wants to buy a piece of karka and hold on to the shtar for the rest of my life? So they gave him a way out. They said, you know what? Hold on to your shtar for 3 years. Mm. After the third year, you didn't hear any mecha, you can be careless about the shtar. Because at that point, the chazaka kicks in and replaces the shtar as proof of purchase. So the chazal say, if that be the case, then the marakama becomes responsible to make sure that he notifies the machzik that he's got to hold on to his shtar. That there's an irur, there's a claim against him that questions his rightful ownership of this karka, and he has no way of defending himself against such a claim unless he holds on to his shtar. That's the way Mechah works. But the problem is, Mechah is very tricky in a case where the original owner finds himself very far away from his karka. You know, he's doing business in China, and back in the days, you know, he's in Galil. Or, for example, he had to run away from his debtors, the creditors, and now how is he going to make a Mechah? So one opinion has it that Mechah shelo b'fanav, have your Mechah. And therefore the Gemara, getting back to the Mimonim, the Gemara says, so what's the case over here? The Machzik says that I had 2 years of Chazok and you were there, and the third year of Chazok you flew the coop. Mimonim shelo. If you flew the coop because of Dinei Nefashos, they're about to, you know, they're wanted dead or alive, then for sure you can't surface to make a Mechah in a public way. And if that be the case, the whole Chazakah is meaningless. Because again, the Machzik has to prove through his Chazakah that there was Shtika, that there was silence on the part of the Marakam, and that's why he had a right to get rid of his Shtar.
Because he doesn't have a Shtar? During that 2 years?
No, I'm just saying, he wants to have rights to be careless, so to speak, about his shtar at the end of the three-year period. What gives him those rights? The fact that he didn't hear a mechah.
For three years.
He heard no mechah. He was at that point careless about his shtar, chucking in the rubbish, I don't need it. I have 3 years of chazakah. I got eight of them to testify in 3 years of chazakah. I'm in the driver's seat. I'm perfectly secure. Okay. But there's one proviso. You have to know for a fact that there was no Mechah. How could you know that there was no Mechah for 3 years if the last of the 3 years the guy was hiding from the authorities who were threatening to put him to death? That's not shtika. You didn't hear silence, right? And if on the... So that for sure, that's upgrade, as we say. That's beyond the shadow of doubt. That's not chazok. That's Boreach Machmas Nefashos.
But that means the Machzik has to be constantly checking for a Mechah, no?
Yes.
And he has to know the status of everyone that could be
making a Mechah. In a positive way, he has to know that the seller, according to his claim, who sold him the karka, we don't know if he's lying or not, but he's claiming that the seller, it was a valid sale, that seller could have made a Mechah for 3 years, and he failed to do so.
So he has to keep track of the seller the whole time?
He has to keep track of the seller. So he finds out that the seller on the third year was underground. Otherwise he'd be beheaded. So he knows that there was no shtika, there was no silence. In other words, the fact that he didn't hear Mechah proves nothing. Therefore he has to continue watching his shtar. If, on the other hand, it was a case of Boreach Machmas Mamon, because the creditors are after him, then he could surface, make his Mechah, and his life is not on the line, and that's valid. And therefore the Machzik again says, well, the third year went by, I didn't hear a Mechah, and therefore I was careless with my shtar. But the Gemara says that only makes sense if you assume Mechah shelo b'fanav of having Mechah, that there is such a thing as a long distance Mechah. How do we know that there is such a thing as a long distance Mechah? This not because we have a mission in the third parak of Baba Basra. Shalosh arotzos lechazaka. There are three districts or states for chazaka: Yehuda, the Eivar Yarden, Valgolin. Now, what happens? Hoya b'Yehuda, the owner of the karka, meaning the Marakama, was in Yehuda, and the field is in Golil, the Hexik b'Golil. And again, it could be the reverse as well. But for 3 years, the Chazaka in Golil was established. Or Hechzik b'Yehuda. I'm sorry. Is Hoya b'Golil, the Hechzik b'Yehuda. That's the reverse. Eina Chazaka. Achiehe imo b'Medina, b'Osa Medina. So it would seem at the surface level that the Mishnah is predicated on the assumption that Mechah shelo b'fanav loving Mechah. And therefore the Chazak is meaningless because the Machzik, even had he made a Mechah, I'm sorry, the Marakama, even had he made a Mechah, that Mechah would not have reached the ears of the Masik. And therefore the Chazok is not a Chazok. So Vavina Bar, and in the Beis Medrash, they asked the following question on the Mishnah, Maika Sovar. There's some sort of inconsistency in this Mishnah. Ika Sovar Mechah Shalom Befon of Havi Mechah. Then Afil Yehuda Begolil, even if the Marakama is in Yehuda and the Masik is in Gol, that should be a valid... That should be a valid chazaka, nami, because since the macha is valid, it's a feasible macha, and if there was no macha, the absence of macha, the chazaka is a valid chazaka. So why does the Mishnah say ain't a chazaka? Because some macha shall lo befanav, lo avi macha, is afil Yehuda v'Yehuda, nami lo. He says there shouldn't be a chazaka even within Yehuda, because how do you know that the word is going to travel from the northern part of Yehuda to the southern part of Yehuda, etc., etc.? And the answer is, Amar Rabbi Abba Bar Mamo, Liolam Kasar Mecha Shalom Befon of Havi Mecha. There is a validity to Mecha no matter how far away he is. And the premise is that the Mecha will somehow reach the ears of the Machzit. Umasnisin Vishas Cherim Shanu. But the Mishnah is talking about a time period where there are battles between the countries. There's confrontation. That's called Shas Cherem. In Hebrew it's called Tigra. Tigra means there's a flare-up. You know, there's a war going on between these two kingships. And in such a case, no one is going to carry the word of the Mecha from one country to the other. You know, the borders are sealed. You know what you're going to see at the borders between these two countries are gunmen. You know, they're shooting in each direction. Or in the old days, the arrows were going through those windows of the coastal, if you know what I mean. So the Gemara says that basically the Mishnah in Baba Basra maintains that Mechah Shalom Befon of Havi Mechah, except for Shas Cherem. Because for Shas Cherem there's no communication, there's no travel. So the Gemara asks, if that be the case, if you're talking about Shas Cherem, Maishna Yehuda V'Golil D'Nokat, why didn't the Mishnah mention Yehuda V'Gol? Here we're going on to Yehuda Chesam and Aleph. This Tam, right? Because again, the Mishnah should have just mentioned that, that there's a Shas Cherem. Why does he single out Yehuda V'Golil? And the Gemara answers that the Mishnah wants to tell me a Chiddush that Stam Yehuda V'Golil Kishas Cherem Domei. That even if there's no outright battle or confrontation between Yehuda and Golil, it's like a Shas Cherem. Why? Because there's not that much travel going on between Yehuda and Golil, and the Mecha of the Marakam is not going to be heard by the Machzik if the Mecha was made in Yehuda and the Machzik is in Golil. So again, just to summarize, because I think we've more or less covered this section. I don't know what time it is here. We have to go for Maariv. You can open the door. Is that the reason why the Mishnah wanted to cover the case of the father is to establish that if there are 2 years of chazaka during the life of the father and the third year during the life of the child, he's a katan, that's not called a chazaka.